Welcome to The Last Thing I Saw for this edition. I'm pleased to welcome back a pairing that we've had, so I'm glad we could get the band together, the trio together, the jazz trio. And that's proceeding alphabetically, Beatrice Eliza. Hello, Beatrice.
Hello.
And Adam Naiman.
Hey there.
I think we can probably dispense with introductions at this point.
The ascendant Beatrice Eliza and the decaying Adam Naiman.
Oh my God, Adam, you're like absurd. Your Canadian self-loathing is too much. Too much.
I'm the one decaying over here, trust me.
Oh my God, we're all decaying.
We're all decaying. Yeah. That's the best sentiment for a podcast I've ever heard.
Well, now that we've got the mood lighthearted, we can get started. First of all, this is a part of your, I can't say I necessarily dread it. I mean, I have various rituals associated with just because I typically end up spending a lot of time looking at people's lists because of various ongoing work engagements I have related to the end of the year. But for each of you, is this a part of year that you kind of dread, or does it clarify for you? Or how does it work for you?
I also dread it. And, you know, so, you know, I've submitted multiple lists at this point, but the very first one I did, which I'm sorry, it was for Sight and Sound, but I just looked back at it because it was published, and I feel I must have blacked out. Like, I did not recognize putting at least three of the things that I put on there. I feel like maybe I'll take one list for in terms of 2023 or releases very, very seriously, but otherwise it's kind of stressful for me, and then sometimes I just put it together very quickly. You know, this being the prime example, this Sight and Sound one. So yeah, I don't really like it, but it is useful, like in retrospect. You know, I have gone through my own list from past years, and it is nice to, you know, see what I was very enthusiastic about or what I deemed putting on sort of an official record.
Well, the Sight and Sound list also, I mean, I don't know if listeners realize, but people get asked that list, I want to say mid-October, is that right?
I think it's a July 5th.
That's right. It felt like it. And, you know, I have no idea what happened there.
Please submit your list of the best films of the year on July 5th.
Early.
I think that I also have the additional problem of living here in Canada where the release dates are basically the same, but not. And I'm a member of the Toronto Film Critics Association, and we have a whole different, you know, criteria for inclusion for that, you know, for that year-end vote, and some of our categories are changing. And I kind of cope with all this year by ignoring list requests from like really good publications, including Sight and Sound and Film Comment. It's bad that I didn't send lists in because I write for them, and it's a way to stay current. But I just didn't do it. So the list I publish for Ringer, and then I'll vote later for CinemaScope, but that's festival premieres and not theatrical, right? So according to the different calculuses, your lists all end up looking totally different. I think Beatrice is right that in past years, I've looked at the first thing I've submitted, whether it's to Sight and Sound or somewhere else, and just thought that it looks crazy.
Yeah, and also the distinction between lists that are a bit more strict about what can be included. Yeah. And so usually it's US distribution, but if you're somebody that attends festivals or for whatever reason has access to films beforehand, you know, something like the Sight and Sound list is a very free-for-all. You can kind of make it determine any criteria that you want for that, which makes it look crazy.
Just looking at, not as an example of what looks crazy, but Beatrice, I mean, your list was interesting to me because it seemed more geared around festival films. Meaning films that you had seen in festivals, which is, I mean, in some ways it offers a variety because it's not going to be from the same pool of, let's say, 30 to 50 films that a lot of other people are going to be choosing from. I mean, it also brings up the question of what's current. I mean, Adam, you used the word current. When is a film out in the world? You know, what is the current? What is cinema right now? Like, I don't know, because I know for general publications, there's kind of a, you could call it a bias, which is that it's geared towards consumer, which is things that are out in the world as theatrical release. But does that really describe what's happening?
There are some lists that you have to compile with the reader in mind. I mean, people sometimes have a misconception about a place like Ringer that they ask you to shape your list in a more populist direction. That's not remotely true on an editorial level, but when I'm putting it together, like I am mindful of who's going to be reading it, right? Mm-hmm. Which means you do push a little bit and try and make people discover things that they might not see. But there's some other movies that, you know, they're just not going to fit. They're not going to fit as well. They're not going to be relevant to put there. So some of it's publication specific and readership specific. I also think that as critics, we're all kind of chasing, if we're allowed, like everyone wants to do their version of when Hoberman put that World Series game on his 10 best list, you know, like how can we, you know, best with the categories and, you know, get something on the list that no one else is going to have there. And then on the other hand, consensus is interesting because I think every one of these film critics is a beautiful snowflake with real taste and true subjectivity and interesting opinions. And then you look at everyone's lists and half of them do have the same movies on them. And I'm interested in what that says. And if one of the things that it says actually is that these movies are all that good, or if it's editorial expectation or regression to the mean. I mean, I wonder about this a lot.
Well, let's stick with you, Adam, for what you had at the top of your list on The Ringer, which is a film that I love as well, Showing Up, the Kelly Reichardt. What brought it to the top there? I mean, partly there is seems to be a mindfulness that you want to make sure people don't miss this film. So that's one.
I kept it there out of the same stubbornness that I admire in Kelly's movies. You know, The stubborn minor key filmmaking that she does. She's not, I mean, among many, many other things, she's not trying to ingratiate herself to awards voters, right? But her status has risen over the last few years in terms of kind of actors who she works with. Working with A24 is supposed to be this skeleton key that unlocks, you know, critical acclaim and box office success. I say that semi-sarcastically because we know it's not true, right? And I think that, as many people have pointed out, had Michelle Williams not been campaigning so strongly for The Fabelmans last year, maybe Showing Up would have been an easier movie to release during quote-unquote awards season. Mm-hmm. But because it didn't come out last year, it didn't get the benefit of going on those 10 best lists last year, which is the year it premiered at Cannes. So I was like, I want to keep this at number one because it's a great movie. But also, yeah, to keep it in people's heads almost a year and a half after most people who write about movies saw it for the first time at Cannes, because it's almost the same thing that happened to First Cow.
Yeah.
And then I looked at most people's 10 best lists, or not most people, but a lot of people who I follow and who I like, and Showing Up was on there. So it wasn't that singular a gesture or anything. But the movie also just belongs there on its merits. It's so funny and principled and such an interesting, bit of thinking on what it means to make art and put it out into the world. I mean, I couldn't like the movie more.
I mean, it's not on my Sight and Sound list because that list is a little wild and all over the place, but I do have Showing Up as well on the list I submitted to Film Comment somewhere within my top 10. It's terrific. And it kind of has the same thing where I also put Pacifiction like high up on my list, but it's weird because I feel like people were talking about it much earlier. And then the fact that it came out in February and now it just feels like it belongs to a different era, but I feel like it had the same sort of, attacked by the same amnesia as Showing Up has been.
Yeah. Well, I mean, as filmmakers, I mean, not to compare them too arbitrarily, but they are kind of interesting because they've definitely had like second and third lives for each of them. You know, with Kelly Reichardt, I immediately just think back to the 2000s and The Old Joy and Wendy and Lucy. And I think Albert Serra as well has sort of come back in that regard. You know, I think there was maybe a bit of a time in a wilderness for him, but Pacifiction I like as well. And I think it's almost against all odds that it rose to the top. It's also remarkable that it won a number of awards or was nominated in a number of awards at French, what are they, the Césars?
Oh yeah, last year. And I think the reason for a sort of mainstream French appreciation is because of the star power of Benoît Magimel, who's just like such a poster boy. Like he's such a beloved icon. And I mean, it's not a flashy performance, but maybe by French standards, the centrality of his character maybe pushed that to seem more important or to seem bigger than what the film and the subtlety of the film would suggest.
And then he's also in The Taste of Things. That's, you know, on a number of lists, although not on either of yours. I guess you weren't into that one.
I liked it, but, you know, it kind of got lost in the lower ranks and the various lists. But I enjoyed it.
I find him pretty amazing in terms of the range of projects that he's done. And then he'll pop up in a weird cameo in, what was the Quentin Dupieux movie that he plays? The one with the time-bending house.
That's the one of the recent ones that I missed. I've seen all
the others. Yeah, I didn't see that one either.
Anyway, jumping over to your list, Beatrice, I guess with the caveat that this is a wild list, as you put it.
Well, I have like two lists and they're like entirely conflicting and...
Wait, what's conflicting
about... Okay. Okay, well, on my Sight and Sound list, it's, you know, I don't stick to U.S. releases. And so I think at the top of that was Last Summer, the Catherine Breillat.
Mm-hmm.
And what I'm kind of telling people is my favorite film of the year is May, December. And that's followed by like Pest Fiction and Dry Ground Burning and a few other random things. But so it's a little different from the list that I submitted. I keep on reiterating this because I'm so baffled at myself.
But you do love last summer. I mean, that's...
I do love it, but it's next year. Well, I don't know. These rules, I'm such a rule follower.
I know, they're absurd. Although both those movies have sort of May-December plots.
It's true. Yeah, no. And I do just generally, I am attracted to narratives that create drama from just sort of bizarre erotic situations or seemingly problematic ones, but kind of approach it not through the conventional sort of moralistic lens. So yes, it makes perfect sense that I really love both of those movies, though they're quite different.
Well, May, December, I mean, I feel like it managed to sort of address that with that. It's serious and funny in a way.
Yeah.
That seemed to be a movie that had hit a sweet spot for a lot of people for a lot of different reasons. People came to that movie with kind of passions in many different ways.
Yeah, no, it's interesting. I mean, I definitely... You know, there were amusing scenes, but I found that a lot of the humor came from Haynes's, the way he like orchestrates certain emotions. Some of the actions that the characters do are very pathetic, but then there's just like a high drama quality to it. And then there's also a banality to like the setting and you know, this location is very, I don't know what to describe, suburban? It's like suburban Savannah. But there, you know, it kind of has a banal, like domestic air to it. And so the way he brings all of this together, I think, easily evokes a sort of nervous laughter. Mm-hmm. I found myself nervously laughing as opposed to feeling like I was reacting to something that was playing for laughs.
Yeah. Adam, that one's also, May, December is also on your list.
Yeah, I have a piece coming out about it. I wrote about it for The New Republic. That review I don't think is up yet because the issue's not out. But I tried writing about humor in the piece, and that's kind of become the dominant discourse around it online, and people have kind of been touching on some interesting things about it as a Netflix release too, which is Todd Haynes tends to make movies that are in a kind of limited release, you know, like they get talked about a lot critically, but if they're end of the year movies, they kind of arrive, you know, in January and February, which is where people see them. With Netflix, not only is like everyone seeing it at once, but it's becoming like screen capped and memed and argued about in a way his movies don't usually have the discourse deluge right away, mm-hmm. you know? And I think so these questions of whether it's supposed to be funny or whether a movie about grooming is allowed to be funny or what is camp have seemed really kind of overwhelming with this film. When you ask about this time of year that's wearying, this is also the time of year where not only are all these big awards releases coming out, some of which don't deserve to be talked about at all and you're sick of hearing about them, but everyone's kind of jockeying for their big takes on all these movies because that's what's going to keep things going from like January to March, right? So this is where it's not no longer a question of are these the major movies of the year, but like what's wrong with them? Or what did everyone get wrong? Or what boxes did they not tick? And the discourse cycle that hasn't started yet or hasn't started in earnest that I'm both anticipating in a sick way and dreading is Zone of Interest, right?
Mm-hmm.
Which we can get into or not, but is going to come out, I think, at a pretty fraught moment and is going to end up on a lot of lists and I think end up with a lot of people saying that they think it's an absolutely awful movie and probably going to be some pretty good like popcorn eating discourse stuff around that too.
Yeah. I definitely want to talk about Zone of Interest. We could do that now, but I was actually just curious, with sticking with May December for a second, like what you felt Todd Haynes was doing with this one, that aside from the particular like reception and yeah.
I think Todd Haynes is always asking himself and us to think about culture and consumption. He's interested in the ways that, you know, stories end up in the media. I mean, it's funny because, you know, he's not like formally or stylistically a filmmaker like David Fincher, but I'd love to see them have an interview or a discussion with each other about, you know, how much medium and message is part of what they do. Like, Haynes went to school for semiotics. I think Fincher practices it more informally, but like they kind of remind me of each other in an odd way. And I think that everything that's interesting to me about May December is he takes this, the Mary Kay Letourneau thing, which some people say is important and some people say isn't, and the 90s-ness of it, which you could argue is the point of the movie or the point of it or not the point of it. But he just then pulls out something that's very, very broad and somehow detailed at the same time about stories and exploitation and what it means to aspire towards celebrity versus having it kind of thrust upon you. And, you know, like, how do you behave when suddenly people aren't paying attention to you anymore? Or how do you behave when you want people to pay attention to you? I mean, that's the stuff that I find fascinating about the movie. And as to whether it's camp or not, I mean, if you study camp or read about camp, there's often two answers to that question at the same time, right? Camp can be a matter of seriousness, or it can be a matter of strained or failed seriousness. It can be something actors are doing independent of the material. And I think anyone who's trying to close off those conversations about this movie, regardless of what Haynes says his intentions are, I don't think they're doing best spectatorship practices in this case. I think you got to be open to the question of comedy and camp in this movie, but that's not the same thing as saying it's making light of these themes or this subject matter.
Yeah, I would agree with that. It's definitely incredibly impressive to me, the kind of tightrope walk it does. You know, it's such a nimble movie in that way. Also, like, it's pretty impressive that this is on Netflix, that this is a movie that is a kind of a true crime story in a way, which is the fodder. I mean, speaking of the medium, but also, you know, after Dark Waters and after Wonderstruck, you know, those are movies that in some ways felt like bids for... I mean, he wouldn't make an explicit bid, but like tapping into kind of wider appeals that, you know, I didn't find super successful for different reasons. But in this case, he manages to hit something for just about everyone.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because to me, it sort of signals a return for Haynes to the sort of expressive women's drama that he's kind of built a fan base for. But I think, you know, at this point, either that fan base or like the culture has moved such that it can be at the center of a cultural conversation and not be sort of like a niche or seem like more so of a niche type of film. I mean, not that his films were incredibly niche before, but it does kind of feel like culturally it's more welcoming of that kind of film, if that makes sense.
Yeah. I mean, it helps also to have this kind of this pairing of actresses in it. I mean, there's always a certain gamble in that, but they just seem to have meshed incredibly well.
Yeah.
So, well, we can't avoid the hand grenade that Adam has rolled in earlier, the Zone of Interest conversation. That one is on your list, Adam.
Yeah. I mean, it put itself there for me. You know, I can't think of a recent film that I had more trepidation about watching based on the filmmaker, right? Which is, I would have said before watching this film that Jonathan Glazer is very talented and I don't want to see him make a movie that's set in and around a concentration camp in the 1940s, because I think his desire and skill at crafting, you know, sinister or violent or malevolent images would sort of get the better of him. And I think part of what I admire about the movie is I feel like those urges are trying to get the better of him at almost every moment. And in resisting them and in restraining them, that's kind of where, you know, the point of view and the value and the tension of the movie comes from. But I have a really odd relationship to enjoying this movie or to admiring this movie, which is I am so much more interested to read negative reviews of it than positive ones, which doesn't mean that I don't trust my instincts on it. I've watched it a few times. I had reason to see it pretty early, despite not being at Cannes because of a particular assignment that I had pertaining to it. And I just actually saw it again on Sunday because I introduced a screening here in Toronto, an advanced screening. I stayed and watched it with my dad, who hadn't seen it and who was very affected by it. I find it's a movie that I'm very confident in why I like it, but I want to have that confidence tested by good critics who have issues with it. And I can almost anticipate what some of those issues are. That's why just one other thing about this time of year, before you guys say what you think of Zone of Interest, is I like reading when people don't like the movies I enjoy. Because I like to think that people will hopefully get something out of me panning or disliking, you know, consensus picks or things that they like. So why shouldn't that work two ways? I'm not panning a piece of crap like Poor Things and sort of thinking like, you know, oh, you know, I don't want people to enjoy this. I mean, I want people to enjoy reading me if I have a different opinion. So I really enjoy, I'm going to enjoy reading people who don't like Zone of Interest, whether it's going to change my mind or make me agree with them. But also there hasn't been that much pushback towards it yet. And I'm very surprised by that. I haven't read those kinds of reviews yet, and I wonder if editors are saving them or if critics are waiting and letting all the positive reception kind of pile up before they're going to start picking it apart.
Yeah, I definitely noticed that too. And I guess speaking as a person who gave it more of a mixed review, I was also surprised by it because at the very least, it was a movie that I was hoping would have that kind of back and forth about it. I mean, when a movie is taking such a powerful kind of formal position as that movie does, I was kind of expecting some more response to it. And I just thought people might be more aware of how his filmmaking has a way of like wrapping you into it and kind of mesmerizing you. I have to say, I mean, this is one of these like nightmare assignments. As far as reviewing goes, having to write a review of this in 24 hours after seeing it at Cannes, which is what I did. So, you know, with qualifications, that's was my initial view of the movie. But I had misgivings about it. I kind of felt that it was a movie that really draws you in with its technical prowess, and that kind of disarms you. And I think kind of distracts from the fact that it doesn't actually hold together. And it actually has, for me, like a huge flaw at the center of it, which is it kind of purports to be, not to give you my whole review, but like it kind of purports to be a movie that is putting you in the shoes of people who are completely insensitive and insensate to what's going on. And that's going to lead to some kind of illumination. I mean, off the bat, I just felt like this wasn't as original a move as it was being treated as, for one thing. But more to the point, I think it kind of copped out in doing that. Because if we were really to identify with these, you know, with the ordinary Germans, it would actually make more of an attempt to make us identify with them. I'm not asking that this movie make them likable, just to clarify, because that's always, I've said this to like a couple people, and they're always like, oh, so you wanted to see more likable Nazis? And it's like, no. I'm just saying in terms of the way the filmmaking functions to distance us from these characters, there's not actually an emotional identification with them that the film that Glazer is doing. And that is what I feel is kind of the cop out, because that's the really hard thing. The hard thing is not when you see some Nazis spouting off awful things, the hard thing is when you see someone who you think might actually be like you, whatever would make you identify with them, and they are having these beliefs and participating.
I have a response to that, but I want to wait for Beatrice to say something.
I'd say that I'm actually in between the two of you. I also wrote very briefly about it out of Cannes, and I haven't seen it again. But you know, my impression was that it was one of the most effective like horror movies I've sat through, just in terms of just how immersive it was and the sound, the just like whole ambiance that it created was like nothing I had ever really sat through. And to create that key of menace and like within its formal constraints was really impressive to me. But I guess echoing what Nick said, I also found that like the bottom line of what it was trying to convey was ultimately pretty simplistic. you know, like the complicity of, you know, these evil people. And, you know, that I found kind of single note throughout the whole thing. And it just kind of held it throughout the whole time. And I think it held it like magnificently, but I didn't think there was more to it, I suppose. And so that's kind of my hesitation with the film.
Yeah. I mean, just quickly, I also share that feeling of it feeling like it's a single note held, and that the various, the couple of two or three departures from that, you know, the, this sort of strange dream or unconscious sequence, which is dazzling in this photo negative style or heat vision style, or the ending where it breaks out to the present. By that point, I just felt like that was mannered kind of gambit. You know, it didn't have this, you know, shaking me back to the present that I sort of felt it was trying to do. But anyway, Adam, please go ahead and demolish.
No, not in the interest of demolition, because I recognize the reaction, right? And when Beatrice said a single note held, I mean, that's a very eloquent phrase. It is sort of a single note held, and that can be redundant, or that can, you know, be indicative of incredible focus, or it could be, you know, both at the same time, right? I felt both of the first times I watched this movie in order to write the way I did about it, and then watching it again, what jumped out at me in the acting that's done entirely without benefit of close-up. I think Sandra Hüller has one close-up in the whole film. Christian Friedel, I think, has one extreme close-up, which is one of the only shots that almost violates the rules the movie has set for itself with the static camera and with the nailed-down camera and the surveillance mechanisms by which he made it. You know, they shot it like a reality show with all the actors and scenes simultaneously in the house. The acting, not just from the two leads, but from everybody, I've decided upon watching it a couple times, it has a completely persuasive quality of total madness to it. Complete and total madness. Madness not being kind of mannered, active, gestural sort of insanity, you know, like a production of Murat Zad or something. But like the madness of people who are not oblivious at all, who are tremendously complicit, and the effort is in the repression of that knowledge, which is why sometimes their bodies and their faces, and at the very end, their insides kind of react in opposition to that. I mean, I find him vomiting on the stairs, which is something that Glazer said was always in the makings of the movie. And boy, did the structure and outcomes at the ending change a lot. There were a lot of back and forth decisions about how to edit this movie. You know, I find that stuff to be incredibly affecting. It ties to what Beatrice said about it as a horror movie, but I think it's one of the most precise delineations of madness that I've just seen in a film. Everyday madness, the sort of point where you internalize it and it becomes normal, but it's like jumping out of the skin of these people at all times. And part of what's so crazy is how fresh everything feels. Because everybody in this movie is convinced, or they've convinced themselves, that this is the start of something that's going to last. And a lot of the insistence that Glazer had with his production designer, that the structures feel new, that the territory feel virgin, that the garden feel freshly planted, that you sort of feel like these people feel that they are at point zero of something that is going to continue forever, balanced against the knowledge we have of viewers, not only of what they're doing, but what's going to happen. Like, I find that tension just so fascinating and spacious and not cutting off thought, but opening up thought to me. So that's, you know, that's where I think the movie's value is. I've really been perplexed by some of the reactions to the movie, where people are like, you know, it's I'm perplexed by the idea that it's not, that it would make them more sympathetic. With the distance and our knowledge of the subject matter, that's impossible. So the minimalism that he kind of plays it with, the fact we don't really get to see them, don't get to know them, they're kind of held slightly at this distance, and we really are just aware of what they're repressing at all times, to me makes sense.
Yeah, I feel like, I don't know what kind of backlash will ultimately come of it, but I certainly know like a lot of people that actively despise this movie. And I think there's like a basic like skepticism of the fact that it's such a muscular film with such bold formal choices, and that I think is not squaring with it having a I don't know, ideal ethical position toward its subject matter. And it's weird to say like showboatiness of it, but you know, there is like a kind of anti-spectacle, spectacular quality to
absolutely
how physically immersive it is. And I think just that boldness is kind of rubbing some viewers the wrong way with, you know, the fact that it's such a heavy subject matter. And there's, and I think, you know, that is where the skepticism comes from. But I mean, I just wanted to say, I feel like I have heard people sort of mocking the ending about, you know, him throwing up. And I'm really glad that you articulated as such, Adam, because I actually really like that end gesture and how it ends. But I think you're exactly right about creating that inner madness aspect.
No, I mean, I definitely appreciate this idea of the repression going on. And I mean, in a sense, though, isn't that a kind of wish fulfillment that he's vomiting at the end, that he is actually experiencing some sort of dissonance? I mean, I don't know.
Well, I mean, Himmler threw up when he visited Auschwitz, which doesn't fulfill a wish. It's nor the fact that it happened historically mean that it's good cinema. But I mean, it sort of is what it is, where it's like,
yeah.
And the fact that he does it twice is what makes it sort of powerful enough to me. Very, very powerful to me. There's like the whole fact that the vomiting is tied to the idea that he's just going to go do it anyway, you know? It's about him going down the stairs to go back home and go back to work. He walks downstairs, throws up, stops. You get projected into the future, which is a very significant time, I think, to put that cut, because the cut to the future is synced to him looking off down that hallway, you know, and then he walks down another flight of stairs, vomits again, and heads off to do it anyway. I find that even if you can sort of look at the gesture and see it as a bit, I don't know, a bit obvious or a bit laughable, that's where actual filmmaking and choices kind of come in and don't just redeem it for me. They inhabit it for me. I think it's devastating.
I mean, it also reminded me of the act of killing.
Sure. Yeah.
That came to mind. I mean, just speaking of some totally other kind of context, but you know, one movie, I mean, just to throw into the mix here, or a couple of them, which I'm kind of curious if they will come up, or because they haven't come up too much. Well, I mean, one that actually screened at Cannes as well, Occupied City. I don't know what it is. Maybe this year I was just at the point where I wanted to see a movie, the stories in Occupied City, more than I wanted to see the story of repressed Nazis in this film. But Occupied City, a lot of people did not respond to. So, but the other movie that I was thinking of, that Son of Saul, I mean, I'm curious how that plays into, you know, thinking about what this movie is doing for each of you. Son of Saul, weirdly, this is a movie that seems to have fallen in a kind of like memory hole, but this is the Laszlo Nemes movie from like 2016.
Oh, right.
Which is, it won the Academy Award for best, whatever it was called then, foreign film. And it is also like a very stringent exercise formally and in terms of perspective and all of that.
That showboating.
Okay.
To me, I reviewed that one for Reverse Shot, and Michael Kresge was very determined to have me review it because he hated it too. I went pretty hard on that movie for Beatrice's phrase, you know, that's sort of like anti-spectacle spectacle, but in that one I found the
spectacle,
I found the aestheticism of that one pretty repugnant, and the plotting of it just so execrable. You know, a movie that I really didn't like, and I wouldn't put words in the filmmaker's mouths for Zone of Interest, but having talked with Glazer, the producer, about the kinds of movies that they were trying to avoid, I don't think that there's a big Venn diagram between Son of Saul and Zone of Interest, even though I totally agree they're a fascinating contrast for sure.
Yeah, I mean, they're both movies that, and in general, you know, you think about questions of history and historical representation, and you know, with Holocaust cinema in general, this responsibility of bearing witness, playing off the fact that this is a medium that lends itself towards stylization and camera choices that frame corpses in different ways, or I guess in Glazer's case, you know, the absence of corpses. And so I think, yeah, they're definitely an interesting contrast, but I feel like thinking about both of them actually makes Glazer's choices seem more complex than our idea that it's actually quite simple.
I am also eager, like Adam, I'm eager to read positions different than mine on the film. I wish I could say I would watch it again because I want to read interviews with Glazer and all of that. I just don't know if I can watch that movie again. Not because I think it's like that bad, but because it, and I'm not saying that it didn't connect with me entirely. It is hard to watch.
Yeah, yeah, for sure.
And I'm also glad that you brought up, like, gave a sort of analysis of how that ending and the filmmaking choices at the end are going there with the bringing to the present, because that sort of move, just to kind of bring us to other movies, it's interesting to see that in a few movies this year, really, this kind of click to the present or some sort of thing, or click to a frame, thinking about how we're telling the stories we're doing, the stories we are telling. I guess the obvious one there is Killers of the Flower Moon, the radio play frame at the end of how that story is being told. And then one other, again, May December.
Oh, right. Yes.
May December, which, spoiler alert, they actually are making the movie. I mean, it's just a sort of a single sequence, but incredible sequence. So I don't know. What do you make of that? I found all of these in different ways interesting.
I'm waiting for Beatrice.
Yeah. No, interesting about Killers of the Flower Moon. I can't really speak to the film now. I think we actually have talked about it on one of your Cannes podcasts, Nick. But I haven't seen it since Cannes. And it seems like it's, you know, the reigning champ among all of the lists that have come out at this point, which, I mean, I enjoyed the film, but it's like, it's not my favorite anywhere like near of the year. I mean, not to sound like, you know, angry brown girl, but I don't know. I just like didn't really connect with its being this like grand ethical statement about, you know, the violence that has built this country. And, or I'm turned off and I have some distance from it. So maybe I'm more responding to discourse around it rather than the film itself, which I found like very enjoyable, as enjoyable a film could be about, you know, killing off indigenous people. I don't know. I feel that there's like something like strangely like white guilty about the fanfare around it. And I don't have any like proof of that. This is just my sense. And it's turned me off to it in general.
Yeah. No, I mean, I definitely, definitely understand that. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. And that combined with like the Scorsese, like adoration, I mean, and I adore him too, but you know, all of this has just created the ick in me.
Well, I did my Scorsese ick thing early, like in the 2000s, where not ick, but I got in trouble with a lot of my friends, and I haven't changed my opinion on a lot of those movies, which is, I think they're kind of bad. The really big budget Oscar chasing stuff in the 2000s, where I kept saying whenever I would write about them or talk to people, I'm like, it's okay. I love Martin Scorsese. He's a great person and a great human being and a force for good. But like The Departed's not good, you know? And so I know what Beatrice is saying, that feeling of the celebration of the filmmaker can sometimes feel, you know, in the wrong ratio to the work they've actually done. I felt with Killers of the Flower Moon that device at the end that Nick was referring to, where sort of the same way as Zone of Interest, I think that's an apt comparison. And, you know, you sort of have this tacit admission that like the artifice isn't enough or the recreation isn't enough. Like you can't just simply recreate or dramatize the history. You kind of have to just give us actual kind of reality or pull the rug out somehow. And I think in Killers of the Flower Moon, the reason stripping the artifice away works is because the artifice of the filmmaking is really, really good in the first place. So it's significant to kind of strip it away. You know, if the movie was a big, saggy, lurching failure, I wouldn't feel anything when the movie gets pulled out from under us like that. To me, the movie has a lot of really strong craft and good performances, and I am absorbed in it, so that move comes as a bit of a shock and a bit of a reckoning. But I'll also say about Killers, not to put it down because I ranked it highly on my list and I like it, I do think the effort that is palpable in it is interesting. This is not a movie that Scorsese can kind of make on fumes, or a movie that Scorsese can make because it all comes to him effortlessly. There are some movies of his that honestly feel like they just went straight from his brainstem to the screen. And while that's not true, it's how it feels. This is very conscientious, right? This is very conscientious. This is thought through. You sense that there was a lot of consultation and collaboration. And even if you didn't sense it, you know it because it's all anybody's written about. And while I don't see that as a bad thing, it's maybe why it doesn't have the absolute kick and propulsion of the very best Scorsese. Even something like Silence, which is really thoughtful, I think, about culture and race and ethnicity and religion, didn't feel quite so checklisted the way that this one did. I don't know if that makes sense to you guys, what I'm saying.
It absolutely does, yeah.
But I'm hugely aware of this idea of inadequacy. And there's a great piece on it. One of the best pieces of film criticism written this year is Adam Piron writing about this exact thing in Killers of the Flower Moon. His piece on this movie is the one to beat, I think, including his not putting words in the piece's mouth. People could read it themselves. But, you know, his question of, you know, what is this movie's success contingent on? And he thinks if it doesn't inspire the ability for more filmmakers to tell this story from inside that point of view, then the movie's kind of a failure, regardless of how good it is.
Right.
It's an interesting take.
Yeah. Well, since we're sort of kind of in the last couple laps here, I just want to make sure we get to a couple other movies as well. And also movies that I won't call them backlashes, maybe the poo-pooing of a couple of movies. I assume that Past Lives is not really a favorite of either of you.
No, it isn't. But I think it's like a very solid debut film. I think that some of the profundity of it, it feels so just kind of, I don't want to say superficial, but sort of basic. These dynamics of being an immigrant, of like having, you know, this conflict between, you know, who you were or what you were connected to in the past towards this idea of the future. I mean, like that's all, I don't know, it's a lovely sentiment, but it all just feels like the fact that it's just there in and of itself, to me, it doesn't create the like deep well of meaning that I think some people seem to be getting from it. And I think the cause for that is because the central character played by Greta Lee, I just found her performance to be like kind of vacuous. Like, I don't think for something like that, where the performance is supposed to create this complexity, this thought process that's going on as she's like living through these moments, like to me, it just felt so empty and it didn't ground the film and make it more than this basic, interesting dynamic that is actually quite relatable, you know, to a lot of people that have, you know, immigrant parents, but also Americans. But, you know, there was a kind of a lack of specificity to it, I think.
I kind of liked the sort of underplaying of Greta Lee in it, or just, I mean, she was, it felt like she was being allowed to have the kind of self-confidence and reserve that maybe more is given to actors than actresses sometimes. And that also maybe just the decision was made to kind of dial down her kind of reaction to it in contrast to, because in some ways the movie could be like a perceived as like a rom-com without the punchlines in a way, in terms of the plotting and mechanics of it. I mean, it's kind of like a platonic ideal for me of a certain type of movie that I usually actually don't like.
I mean, actually, that's interesting you say there was sort of a gender reversal in terms of its performance style, because I thought the men in the film were quite good, but that was kind of troubling to me because I don't think that they should have been pulling the focus away from her.
It violates the cardinal rule, which is never have any scene set at a writer's retreat. unless you're going to introduce some kind of swamp monster or serial killer, do not set movies at writer's retreats.
And don't portray it as idyllic in any way.
Yeah.
Like an enviable place that we would all love to do as writers. Like, no, it's absurd.
I was very happy to see a Toronto's Pearson Airport make a couple of cameos in Past Lives.
Oh, really?
There's some very nice directing in it. To credit where it's due, there's some really nicely managed sequences and some, you know, very striking compositions, but I'm a little surprised seeing it high on a lot of year-end lists. I think like as a mid-year list movie, it made sense. I'm surprised it still hanging around at the end of the year. But hey, again, smart distributor.
It's pretty devastating. That's probably the most devastating thing you've said, Adam. Pretty good mid-year list selection.
Right on the mid list.
calling it as I see it.
I mean, I sort of was surprised by, I am surprised and not surprised by the support for Fallen Leaves.
It's a solid movie. I enjoyed it a lot. But I feel like the support actually makes sense because it's firmly like a Kaoru's Maki movie, but it also is working within the very recognizable sort of romance with like a social bent trappings that I think is making it so that it is having such a successful run. And it seems it's part of this awards conversation. You know, all of that kind of makes sense to me, given the thrust of the film and the sort of basic romance at its center.
I mean, does it speak to a failure to make that kind of film in Hollywood to a certain extent as well? I mean,
Yeah, I think so.
I think it speaks to the success of Kaoru's Maki to make the movie he always makes. Like, I love that this is the fourth part of a trilogy. You know, like there's something very reassuring about that. And there are certain directors, I think, where that reassurance, like the thrill of minor variations in a form, or the idea that you can return to this universe and its rules are always the same, there's real comfort in that. Like, I was trying to think of the differences between Kaoru's Maki and Hong Sang-soo, and there's probably about as many differences as there are similarities. But every time I sit to watch a Hong movie, whether I love it or not, I'm sort of excited to visit that tiny little corner of the universe and know that I'm not being faced with the whole universe, just this part of it. I feel like he knows that part of it pretty well. You know, Kaoru's Maki is not a filmmaker who tries to give you the world. You know, he gives you like 8 square blocks. And that's a nice thing,
yeah.
Especially when you are making a list. Lists are always survey-like in nature. People try not to be too repetitive. And with Kaoru's Maki, you cover a certain number of bases. You know, he's a veteran auteur. He's a European filmmaker. He's not fashionable. He's not like a gentrified genre filmmaker. No one's going to look at you and sort of say, like, you know, you're being trendy by picking him. I mean, I'm not saying people are that cynical in their lists, but there's always a little bit of presentation and, you know, Pinterest-like curation when you make your list. So, I mean, I had Fallen Leaves on mine, and I don't think I saw 10 better movies this year, but I think putting it there feels good.
Yeah, no, it's on my list too. But I think you're right in terms of the specifics of him, you know, being Kaoru's Maki, but I think it's also a matter of stars sort of aligning. Like, yes, he's wonderfully specific in himself and his movies, you know, they're unique, but I think, you know, what Nick was saying, it's also a matter of it filling a void within a certain kind of Hollywood filmmaking, and I mean, all of this coming together this year.
Yeah. Well, I have more things I want to ask you guys, but I know we only have a certain amount of time. But Beatrice, I also want to just ask about a couple films on your list, you know, that aren't out in the US and or may not have any plans to do so. Since these lists are so good at just bringing things to people's attention, is there a particular film there that you're like especially excited for people to discover? I mean, I would just say that a lot of people might be curious about The Face of the Jellyfish, but I don't know if there's another one you have in mind there.
Yeah, let's see my sound list. I had The Face of the Jellyfish, which is this film by this Argentinian filmmaker, I think.
Yeah.
Melissa Lebenthal, which I saw at Berlin. And I think it was at New Directors New Films here in New York. I mean, it's just like a really smart but subtle dour comedy about this woman. She like wakes up and she just has somebody else's face, and so it's just like her going about her daily life being like, well, you don't have the same face anymore, but you're the same person. And so there's a sort of, you know, there's that magic element to it, but it's played in a completely just like naturalistic and droll way. And, you know, the main person, the main character is supposed to be the filmmaker herself, but it's played by an actress because she just randomly has a different face. Anyways, it's really, really smart. And I really hope it gets distribution next year. But I mean, otherwise, other shout outs. I mean, the new Radu Jude, which was like one of the best things I saw this year, that is definitely coming out next year. That's on my sound list. It's terrific. Terrific film. And I didn't really like his last film, Bad Luck Banging. I thought it was a kind of faux, there's a lot of faux provocation to it in my mind that here is just feels so, I don't know, it just like glides effortlessly out through the highway, which is a theme in the film, just driving. But yeah, those are two things on the list that people should be excited about, whether or not they come out.
Yeah, yeah. Adam, I was just looking, you know, on your list, a couple films. I guess Knock at the Cabin would be, I mean, I don't want to make you have to go through the whole M. Night Shyamalan.
No, that was the one I was hoping you were going to ask about.
Okay, great. Yeah. Also, because we haven't talked too much about, I mean, we've sort of referenced like horror films, but just in terms of a movie that is operating more with in the realm of genre.
Oh, before you get into it, Adam, yeah, speaking of genre, I, in my like top 20 for another list I submitted, I put The Evil Dead, which I don't remember if you like what your thoughts were. I thought it was a lot of fun. But I just know that you wrote about it. So
yeah, I wrote about it for Film Comment. I liked Evil Dead Rise, although, you know, it's like a victory lap over stuff that other people did well. You know, it's just like fun to see someone else do it.
Yeah.
But I liked Evil Dead Rise. I mean, for Knock at the Cabin, it's the only one of the movies on my top 10 list that I got like straight up hate mail for. People found my U of T account.
Oh, wow.
Because I teach there. And they were like, I just want to let you know that any list that has Knock at the Cabin and not Oppenheimer means you shouldn't do your job.
What the hell?
Well, and I'm like, I wrote them back. And I'm like, I'm glad you found my email address. Talk anytime. You know, I find that I really am in a very similar way to Karismaki. I'm a sucker for those filmmakers who have their little corner of the cinematic imagination kind of staked out, and they have the confidence to play there, you know? And I think Shyamalan is on the most interesting winning streak, odd, self little carved out niche of any filmmaker I can think of in the United States over the last 10 years, where after becoming this giant punchline, he finally like figured out how to be funny on purpose and, you know, made like a great found footage horror movie with The Visit and like totally hijacked the superhero movie moment to his own purposes with that bizarre, you know, Unbreakable franchise. And then in Old and in Knock at the Cabin, he does this kind of existential, you know, phenomenological dread where they're like kind of Twilight Zone episodes, and everything about them that's a turnoff for people, like the stilted acting and the fuzzy metaphysics and the sort of weird, like they're so ruthless and mean, but they're also not R-rated. Like it's like PG-13 violence. Like I find this stuff so beguiling in combination. And when I was putting that list together, I thought Knock at the Cabin and A Fire, the Petzold movie, made so much sense put together because they're kind of both movies about vacations gone awry that have incredible dread in them about the end of the world. I mean, there's something apocalyptic in A Fire, and I find the way Petzold expresses it is honest to the kind of filmmaker he is, and I think Shyamalan expresses it in a way that's honest to the kind of filmmaker he is, and I'd like to think, I'll ask him next time I talk to him, but like, I think Petzold would like Shyamalan's movie. Mm-hmm. I don't know what Shyamalan would think of Petzold's movie, but I think Petzold, who's pretty good with American pop cinema, probably would say Shyamalan's on a heater as well. So I think M. Night's great. And I don't know what you guys thought of Knock at the Cabin, but I had a good time.
I enjoyed it.
But I'm
like you. I just generally love all his movies.
Yeah.
This was not my favorite. By any stretch, it really wasn't. But I mean, I had a great time. Yeah. And I must say, A Fire, you know, loved your debut role, Adam.
Yeah, I've been taking shit for this all year too. People in Berlin were like, wow, good performance.
Yeah. No. Yeah. Since Berlin, everyone knew Adam Neyman's starring role in Christian Petzold's movie as the surly writer.
Yeah, then when my wife, who's had to put up with me hiding with my laptop at the cottage for most of our life together, is like, not funny at all.
And the self-loathing.
And the self-loathing.
Good enough.
Absolutely.
You started out the podcast this way.
Well, you know what? I wish, because that guy's a good actor. He's great.
Well, Beatrice, did you have a debut role this year? Or?
Did I have a debut role? No. The only comparisons I tend to be, my like movie doppelganger, I've been told, is Aubrey Plaza, not because we look so much alike, but I guess speech mannerisms and this fact that we both cannot control rolling our eyes. Like, often people think I have an attitude towards them. I'm like, I just can't control my eye rolling. I'm not trying to be sarcastic.
That's great. Yeah. Well, you know, just talking about these end of the world movies, also just a good place maybe to wrap up. I guess we can expect a lot from the end of the world.
Well done.
Oh, wait, I'm sorry. I completely forgot. I did want to ask any first viewings, movies, first watches from this year that you particularly just want to put out there.
I think it was this year for the first time I saw Vengeance is Mine by Michael Romero. That was great.
Oh, wow. Nice. Yeah, terrific.
I am going to say something I watched this week for the first time. I went to Museum of Moving Image and I saw all 330 minutes of Mildred Pierce.
Oh, wow.
The Todd Haynes mini. Yeah, I cried a lot. Thought about my mom. Terrific.
Well, full circle with Todd Haynes.
Yes.
All right. Well, thank you both. Obviously, this is still just a fraction of you know, what we could say. And I ask everyone to go read everything that you guys are writing. Thanks for taking the time.
All right. Great time. Thank you.
Hey, thank you.
You've been listening to The Last Thing I Saw with host Nicholas Rapold. You can support the podcast by signing up at rapold.substack.com. Thank you for listening.